told me later that some of the anti-teacher propaganda was motivated by the school board concerns. But in any event, he was a very steady influence in terms of believing in both education and excellence. There were always books around the house. My mother and dad both read all the time. And my mother had a habit, which I have, that when she started reading, if she was interested in reading something, you had to literally either shake her or shout at her to break her concentration. So there were always books in the house. They were always interested in music. My parents bought season tickets to the Cleveland Symphony at least as early as 1946. And had those season tickets until they could no longer go to the symphony. My brother now has those seats. On their 50th wedding anniversary, we bought the seats for them. I don't mean buying the tickets. I mean, we gave a contribution, my brother and I, between us, gave a contribution to the symphony. And their names are on the backs, on plaques, on the seats in Simmons Hall that they had for all those years. That was our 50th wedding anniversary gift. My dad used to work not only teaching school, but he worked at night school, teaching chemistry at night school at John A. High School. And when I was in high school, I was his chemistry lab assistant at night. That was a job they had to have, so I was the lab assistant at night. He also, when I was growing up, except during the war years, or maybe even during the war years, to make some extra money, sold shoes on Saturday, shoe store, Chisholm shoe store on Saturday. So he was working seemingly all the time. My mother carried into the house the same thing she was known for at school. She was a very strict disciplinarian. She was known for being a disciplinarian in school, and you meet some of her former students now. I was in Dallas for the Union of American Hebrew Congregations biennial a couple of months ago, and you have badges that give your name and your city, and I'm riding up in the elevator, and I get off the elevator, and a woman who I had no idea who she was said, are you originally from Cleveland? Because the badge tells your name and your city. He said, Pittsburgh. I said, yes, I am. She said, was Clara Cowan your mother? And I said, yes, she was. How did you know? Because this woman was from someplace in Florida. She said, I grew up in Cleveland, and she was my teacher. And she said, then she said, is she still alive? And I said, yes, she is. And she said, is she still as strict as she was when she was my teacher? Well, my mother carried that in the house, too. I mean, you didn't get away with anything in the house. As I say, we lived on the second floor of a duplex. And on our street, with a couple of exceptions, they were all duplexes. And there had to be, on each side of the street, in the course of maybe 10 or 12 houses on each side, there had to be at least 20 boys within an age range of about 4 or 5 years when I was growing up. And so we used to go out in the street and play football or baseball or what have you. I can still remember my mother calling and our leaving immediately upon the call, because the consequence, if you didn't, was not something you wanted to contemplate. So there was that in them, so they're very strict, tempered by my dad. So my mother was a disciplinarian.
What's the difference in ages of your brother and you?
I'm almost 4 years older than my brother. My brother was born in January 1938. He'll be 60 years old this January. So I'm almost 4 years older than he was. And so when we were growing, when we were little kids, of course, he was, when you're 10 and he's 6, that's a big age spread. Now it's not so great, but he was always the little brother to him.
This is January 6, 1998, the start of a new year, and it's the start of our second session with Mr. Barton Cowan, National History of Jewish Women. Judy Rubenstein and Marcy Schwartz are interviewing. Bart, last session we talked a lot about your early family background and growing up and your education, and as I recall, you were just about to take off to go to Michigan, perhaps.
Not to Michigan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Where was it? Excuse me. Where did you go to college?
Oh, you're talking about in the family history.
Right.
Okay, no. When I graduated from high school, from Cleveland Heights High School, in 1951, I went to the University of Michigan for undergraduate school in their College of Liberal Arts. Mm-hmm. And I graduated from Michigan in 1955.
Okay, do you want to tell us a little bit about your years there? What it was like in the 50s, early 50s, and what you...
Well, Michigan in the early 50s was a relatively small school compared with the size of the university today. I think there were about 17,000 students all together at the university, about half of whom were graduate students. And of course, there are a lot of different schools and colleges in the university, so it was in pretty small groups. Some of the veterans from the Second World War were still there, finishing up graduate schools. And so some of the temporary veterans housing was still there. Mm-hmm. They had just embarked upon a building program to build a series of new dorms. Mm-hmm. And although I lived in one of the older dorms the first semester, I moved into a brand new dorm the second semester. I lived in dorms at Ann Arbor for 3 years, and then in the fourth year I lived in my senior year, I lived in a fraternity house. I belonged to Todd Elder Phi fraternity.
Was there a particular reason why you selected the University of Michigan?
Yes. When I was graduating from, or when I was a senior in high school, I applied to only three schools. I applied to Michigan, to Cornell, and to Harvard. I got into all three. But my dad had gone to the University of Michigan. He had both a bachelor's and a master's degree from the university, and I had probably first gone up to Ann Arbor when I was a very small boy. There are pictures of me running in the Michigan Stadium when I was 3 years old. And so over the years, I had gone up to Ann Arbor quite a bit, so I'm sure that was a heavy influence in going
to the natural feeling.
One of the things I remember about Michigan, I don't remember from then, but I, many years later, my dad told me, and he had the records to show it, that my first year at Ann Arbor, for the entire year, my room, board, tuition, books, transportation, and incidental expenses were under $500.
For the first year?
For the whole year, for the entire year. The tuition for in-state, I think was either $60 or $90 a semester. I think it was $60 a semester, and out of state was $90 a semester for tuition. It seems hard to believe in this era when we have $30,000 a year schools.
But, as we
Michigan today is the comparable cost would be $25,000 to $30,000 for an out of state student today. But he startled me when he told me that many years later, and he had kept meticulous notes and had that record. I still remember the day I went up to Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. Because my parents drove me up from Cleveland I had been debating whether to become a member or to try to become a member of the Michigan Marching Band. And we arrived in Ann Arbor, I think we may have stayed overnight in Detroit the night before, but we arrived in Ann Arbor in the morning, and there was a sign posted about tryouts for the Michigan Marching Band at 2 o'clock or some such time that afternoon. And so I had lunch with my parents after checking into the dorm. I had lunch with my parents, and they dropped me off at the band headquarters and proceeded on their way to drive back to Cleveland. I think if they hadn't dropped me off, I would not have tried out for the band. I marched in the Michigan Marching Band for 4 years.
Playing
the trumpet. And so I still remember them leaving me there all alone to go into this, into the marching band headquarters building. It turned out that probably the most influential professor that I had in my 4 years at Michigan was Dr. William Revelli. William Revelli, R-E-V-E-L-L-I, who was the director of the University of Michigan Bands. I never had him for a formal course, but of course when you march in the marching band, you spent more time with the marching band in the fall and into the early winter than you spent on any course. We practiced every day for an hour and a half to 2 hours every day, and on Saturday mornings, all morning, and then of course the games were in the afternoon. Sunday was a day off unless he felt that we weren't playing as well as we should have been, and then we had a practice session on Sunday. Dr. Revelli was a perfectionist. There was no substitute. There was no coming in second. There was nothing other than perfect perfection that would please him. And it showed in a lot of ways. And that drill, that constant drill, stuck with me. It stuck with me all through my life. There were other influential professors that I had, professors who influenced my life, but Dr. Revelli, far and away, was the...
Do you still play the trumpet?
Not really. I can still play. I have gone back, before our kids went away to college, we used to go back for a Michigan game every year or two, my wife and I. And even after, when our kids were in high school and junior high, we took them up. And in the fall, they always have a band alumni day. And I used to go back for the weekend of band alumni day, and we used to practice in the morning and then march and the band alumni out on the field. I haven't done that since the kids went away to college, because then I went to where they were for the weekend and not to Ann Arbor. In preparation for band alumni day, I would pull out my trumpet, which I still have. And I'd pull it out a week or two ahead of time, and would do a little bit of practicing so that I could at least play the victors. But if they had to rely on me for the music, I'm afraid they wouldn't have very good music. But the things you learn about playing the trumpet still serve in good stead. I can blow the shofar. I blew the shofar at Rosh Hashanah for the holidays this past year.
Have you done it for many years?
No, this is the first time, and I was not. We have two services, and I blew it in the Levy Hall. They needed somebody to blow the shofar, and
did you use a mouthpiece?
No, used a regular shofar.
Wonderful.
And so I can. I suppose if I practiced, I could still play. But
did you love the football as much as?
Oh yes.
Most of the people in Michigan.
Yeah, yes. My dad, who was, I think I mentioned last time, was a high school teacher. At various times, in addition to teaching chemistry and physics, coached different athletic teams at the high school that he taught at. And at one point, he coached football, not the head coach, but it was an assistant. And it was not uncommon when I was growing up, before I went away to Michigan, it was not uncommon for me to see a high school football game on a Friday night, a college game, Case Western Reserve or one of the other local colleges, on a Saturday and a pro game on a Sunday. So I grew up on liking football and still do. I watched the, as you know, Michigan won the Rose Bowl game. We're undefeated this year and voted co-national champions, and I watched that game without interruption, the Rose Bowl game without interruption. I remember a lot of them. I mean, there's just a lot of things I remember about Michigan.
Tell
us. We were there at a time when the country was in transition. While I was in Ann Arbor, Eisenhower became president, Truman having been president up until 92, or I guess January 93. 53. Eisenhower became president, and so things in the country were in reasonably quiet. It was very conservative time. The clothing was conservative. And a lot of the things that now occupy the press and occupy our society weren't even thought of in those days. Mm-hmm. And so it was a good time to go to school, a good time to be in school. Mm-hmm. I majored in economics. I took a lot of courses in economics. And had some first-rate professors in economics. I was in ROTC when I was at Ann Arbor, and was commissioned a second lieutenant and was due to go into the Air Force. I really wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know it from the way my prescription is now, but in those days I did not wear glasses and I had 20/10 vision in both eyes, in each eye, and passed all the physicals for pilot mm-hmm. training. The Korean War, of course, was on, mm-hmm. and it had ended by the time I graduated, and the Air Force was going through both a downsizing and a time when they thought that missiles would take the place of airplanes. And so even though I wanted to go to pilot school and become a pilot, they were not calling us right away when we graduated. They were giving us deferments. They gave me almost a year, so I went away to law school.
Had you thought about law school while you were in college?
Oh, yes. I had intended to be a lawyer ever since I can remember. But I did, and I took the LSATs in the fall of my senior year, but I didn't apply to any law schools because I was due to graduate in June in, of 1955 and due to go to the Air Force shortly thereafter. But in sometime in January of 1955, I got my orders, and my orders were to report in May of 1956. And so I decided, well, I better apply to law school right away. And I sent off my application. I only applied to one law school. I only applied to Harvard. I sent off my application either on a Saturday or a Monday. But that Friday, I got a return acceptance.
That fast to Harvard Law School?
That fast.
Now,
in those days,
in what,
1955.
Wow. And what month was that?
This would have been in February of 1955.
Wow.
In those days, of course, they didn't have the numbers applying to the law school.
One still had to have the grades. Would you like to tell us about some of your accomplishments at Michigan?
Well, I was, in addition to the marching band, I was in a lot of other student type of activities. Some of them organized like student government, and some of them not so organized like intramural football and various other intramural sports. One strange thing happened when I first went away to Michigan. And I graduated from high school. I was about 5'2" tall, and I grew 6.5 inches in my first 6 months after graduating from high school, basically in my first semester at Ann Arbor. I came back for Christmas vacation in my first year at Ann Arbor, And I had grown from the end of the summer to Christmas vacation about 5 inches.
Is that unusual?
Very unusual.
What does an endocrinologist say about that?
They don't know. But if you look at the pictures of me in high school, and you look at the pictures standing next to people, you find that if I'm not the shortest person in the class, I'm one of the two or three shortest boys in the entire high school class. I graduated in a big class of 340 or 50 people. And I was very short. And I had that sudden growth spurt when I went away to college.
And you were 18 then?
I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
I was 17. They're very unusual. My parents had to buy me all new pants and other stuff because nothing fit when I came back. One of the things I remember, I was at Ann Arbor when Jonas Salk, who did his work here at the University of Pittsburgh, but the collation of that work was all done at Ann Arbor, all done at the University of Michigan, and the announcement of the Salk vaccine was done in Ann Arbor. And I was there when that occurred, and I remember all the excitement on the campus at the time when they announced that, because we don't think of it now, but polio was a great threat when I was growing up. And polio, of course, now I guess it's not a threat at all, but it was that vaccine and the Sabin vaccine later on that really knocked out.
It was a threat in what way? I mean, people couldn't swim?
Well, you didn't. You had to be very careful. Nobody quite knew, at least I didn't think anybody quite knew how you got it, but there was always a fear if you went swimming.
In August,
in the summertime, in late summer, there was always a fear that you would come down with polio. And if there was a scare, nobody went swimming. It's hard to really picture the fear that there was in those days. And so the Salk vaccine was a tremendous advance. And I can remember that when they announced that. I think I was a senior at that time.
Did you join a fraternity right away? Or?
No, I joined a fraternity in my junior year.
It was Tau Delta Phi.
My parents didn't want me to join a fraternity. And a number of my friends did not join the fraternity. So I did not join. And my second year, I decided that, I'd sort of like to be in a fraternity. And my parents, I remember my mother saying, make you a deal. If you get all A's, you can join a fraternity. The only semester I got all A's at Michigan, and I had good grades at Michigan, but I didn't get all A's any other semester. But the only semester I got all A's was the semester when I needed them to have her live up to her promise. I roomed at Ann Arbor with a fellow from Cleveland named Lawrence Schreiber. Larry is now a child psychiatrist, and for many years, I don't know if he still is, was the head of head psychiatrist at the Belfair in Cleveland, which is a Jewish children's home. And now I guess it's expanded into that role. So I roomed with Larry for, not my first semester, but after my first year, I roomed with Larry when I was in the dorms. I also roomed with a fellow named Dieter Hanauer. Dieter Hanauer Myers for 1 year. Dieter was from Cleveland also. He had been born in Germany and got out just before the Nazis started making things, I guess they started making things tough in the early 30s, but he got out in about 38 or 39 and was brought to Cleveland and raised in the home of David Myers. David Myers is a Cleveland philanthropist, a major contributor to the Jewish home there. In fact, David Myers Drive is the name of the drive outside of Menorah Park in Cleveland. And Dieter was his adopted son. So I room with Dieter. Dieter is now a dentist and very active and charitable in affairs in Cleveland.
What was Dieter's name?
Dieter Hanauer, H-A-N-A-U-E-R, Myers.
His family obviously didn't.
His family, he, as far as I know, Dieter was the only one of his family who got out. There, he may have been a brother who got out. I don't remember that.
And he's a dentist, right?
And he is, I believe, a dentist, but he is basically in charitable and family. Mm-hmm. Family. And of course, in my senior year, I lived in the dormitories. In the fraternity house in Ann Arbor. And some of my best friends are former fraternity brothers of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Fraternity brothers of mine. I roomed all 3 years in law school with one of my fraternity brothers.
Oh. Was Ann Arbor, you described the country as being somewhat conservative. Was Ann Arbor any more liberal compared to the rest of the country as it has been in recent years?
Not really. In those days, Ann Arbor was pretty conservative too. We did have 1 year, probably my second year at Ann Arbor, the so-called panty raids. That was a radical departure from anything that occurred. But other than that, it was a pretty conservative place. The school was hard. I could only remember taking one course that was really a soft course. I needed some science courses. When I entered Ann Arbor, although I said I wanted to be a lawyer, I had some fleeting idea that maybe I wanted to be a doctor. Took chemistry in my first year there, and that disabused me of the idea that I wanted to be a doctor. I think I got a B+ in chemistry, but that was a hard course to take, and it made me think maybe I don't want to be a doctor. But I needed another science course, and so either my third year, I guess it was, or fourth year, I took astronomy. And astronomy was a 3-hour lecture course in the fall at a lab that was counted as 1 hour credit, but was a 3-hour lab at night. And the lab was taught by somebody different than the lecture course. And what I most remember about astronomy was the only soft course I had at Ann Arbor, was that it was the course of choice for those who needed their science requirement but didn't really want to work very hard. And we had about 30 or 35 people in the lecture section, and about 20 of them were football players. And of course, we were in the fall semester. And so Fridays were devoted when the game was at home. If the game was away, the football players were away on Friday. But if the game was at home, Friday was devoted to a discussion of the forthcoming game. Or as the professor used to say, we're going to talk about the game tomorrow and its bearing on astronomy. Is it written in the stars? And Monday was devoted to a discussion of the game of the prior Saturday. So there was 1 day of astronomy lecture surrounded by 2 days of astronomy football, or whatever you want to call it. On the other hand, the lab course, which was taught by a woman professor named Hazel Losh, turned out to be a very difficult lab. She really taught I learned a lot more of astronomy in the lab than I ever learned in these lectures. And she turned out to be a very tough professor. You could not take the lecture without the lab, and so we had to do both. And some of us did all right in both courses, obviously, but I don't know whether the football players did.
What were the courses that you liked best?
The economics courses. I took political science from a professor who was, he was either a visiting professor or else he was, had just been appointed to the faculty, but he previously had been a professor in a southern one of those big state universities in the South. And he was born and raised in the South, and he spoke with a distinct Southern accent. He used to talk about the late, to call the Civil War the late lamented aggression of the North. He taught a very good course, though. But the economics courses were the ones I remember the most.
Were there any other professors that you mentioned?
Well, in economics, there were a number of professors who were pretty well known. There was Shorey Peterson was one of the full professors. There were a number of professors in labor economics, and we had a for a senior thesis in economics if we were a major. A paper I wrote about competition in the automobile industry, or more correctly put, the coming decline in competition in the automobile industry. Of course, there were no